Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're going to set the stage for something that everybody's doing, which is cooking at home. And we're going to get you urged to get into your kitchen for a number of reasons and start cooking.
Yeah, people doing it more successfully.
Yes.
People doing it with love. People doing it as a way of bonding their family together.
And our first guest, she has a really interesting personal story, and she has an inspiring message to deliver. Her book is called Homemade with Love, and believe me, she makes just about everything.
With love.
I have to mention that the first thing I spotted on this book, actually, by Jennifer Perillo, who we're going to be talking to, is that the photographs are so luscious, and they're by Penny de los Santos, which, of course, she's one of my favorite photographers. Jennifer, your book is called Homemade with Love, Simple Scratch Cooking from In Jenny's Kitchen, which is your blog?
Exactly. My blog is In Jenny's Kitchen, and thanks for having me on today.
Oh, sure. I know you're really busy. Are you on a book tour?
I am. I'm on a book tour right now. I just got back from North Carolina on Saturday night, and I'll be heading to San Francisco. I have a reading at Omnivore Books on April 30th.
Oh, okay. Great. A lot of good eating in San Francisco.
Lots of good eating in San Francisco.
Anyhow, people are currently in love with homemade, but at the same time, people just don't seem to have the time. Is that the part of the gist of this? You're able to simplify everything, simplify the techniques, prepare in advance, get organized so that people can actually have a homemade meal on the table every night, huh?
Exactly. No, I think that there's definitely a fascination with food blogs, obviously with the Food Network and cooking shows, but in some ways cooking has become a bit of a spectator sport. People think it looks so great to watch, and the idea of a homemade meal is really exciting, but then when people really have to get down into the kitchen, it can be a little bit of an intimidating process, whether it's because of the technique or the time that's involved. And really, that's the promise that I'm trying to live up to with Simple Scratch Cooking, is to show people that you can have a homemade meal. You don't need to go shopping for a bunch of crazy exotic ingredients, and it can be done in an achievable amount of time with very easy to understand techniques.
And there are things that your kids, you are a single mother of two, and there's things that really appeal to your children, and you're nurturing and feeding them nutritiously all at the same time.
I'll be honest, getting into the kitchen, feeding a four-year-old and a nine-year-old, it sometimes can be a little bit of a daunting process because I have a certain flavor palette, and the girls obviously have another one, too. But that's where I try to find those compromise recipes like the mushroom bolognese. They like tomato sauce and pasta. I get to chop the mushrooms up in there so that it fleshes out flavor. It feels a little bit heartier for me. It's a great way to get the kids to eat mushrooms as well, too, and find it more palatable. But I really do believe in that family dinner time experience, that meal time where we sit down at the table and we connect. I get to talk to them about how their day was at school, and I love that my oldest daughter, who's nine, will always say to me, "And Mommy, how was your day? What did you do today?" So it's more than just the actual meal that we're eating. It's the emotional experience that we're creating and the memories that we're building with each other that they're going to carry into adulthood and hopefully then share with their own families as they grow up.
Well, now, the funniest thing is that we raised our son exactly that way. But do you think they serve dinner every night in their house? I swear the only time they fix dinner as a family is when I'm there to cook it.
Oh, my heavens, now you're making me nervous. I hope that my girls, I will say the seedling of hope that I do have is I've had a really busy schedule with the book tour. And every time I've come home after a couple of days, I'm very fortunate. I have my aunt, who's their great aunt. She comes up from Florida and she stays with them while I'm traveling. And every time I come in from another city, I always have something, a really beautiful homemade treat. My oldest daughter, the first time she opened up the cookbook, and she had a homemade egg cream waiting for me on the table.
Oh, what a doll.
I just came back from North Carolina, and she's like, "Okay, Mommy, close your eyes." And at the table, I had a homemade sugar cookie. They had a bake sale at the school for Earth Day, and my aunt made cookies with them to sell. And I had a beautiful homemade sugar cookie that was cut out in the shape of a daisy and a glass of milk waiting for me. So she's obviously has the connection between what food can do for you, and cooking from scratch, that it does heal your heart and feed your heart. So I'm hoping that when she leaves the house, she's going to carry that over with her.
I hope so, too.
Exactly.
Sounds like you're off to a wonderful start. So for that reason alone, you are to be congratulated on this book, because there must be something in the book that really encourages that to happen, don't you think?
I think so. And one of the things I have been most proud of is so many people who have told me their kids have gone into the kitchen. The lemon buttermilk donuts, which are on the cover of the book, that's a recipe that so many of my friends and strangers alike, I'll get a little note that says, oh, our kids made the donuts this weekend, because it's such an easy recipe to understand. It's such an easy technique for them to actually do in the kitchen with easy, accessible ingredients. I taught a kid's cooking class recently, and we used the all-purpose baking mix. I wanted to show the kids how if they mixed a couple of these dry ingredients, they could make pancakes and cupcakes with just using a scoop of that same mix. And so many of the kids, not only did they make the deep chocolate cupcakes by themselves at the cooking class, but they went home and were so inspired that they took recipes from the cookbook and then made their parents dinner that night, or they made them breakfast the following weekend. See a toy that says from ages 5 to 95. That's really what I think of Homemade with Love. It's a cookbook for ages 5 to 95 as well.
Now, one of the genius tips, you give a lot of tips in getting organized to do this, is that you make ahead this all-purpose baking mix. And you mentioned you grew up with Aunt Jemima. I guess we all did.
I did. That's what my mom had at the table. And when I was creating the book, there's a lot of this philosophy for cooking from scratch, which I think can be a little intimidating because it requires having a pantry filled with a lot of ingredients. And when I first was working on the cookbook proposal, I had a pancake and waffle mix. And then I decided I was going to add a muffin mix. And then one day I thought, okay, this is silly. We're just going to make one mix that makes pancakes and muffins. And I thought, you know what? I want to go and really show people that they can free themselves from that box all-purpose mix that they're buying in the supermarket that has a lot of additives and fillers and preservatives, that you can make it at home. And that's really what pushed me and inspired me to do further testing and work out those ratios of the baking soda and baking powder to really have it be a mix that you could make breakfast with, you could make a snack, you could make dessert with it. And I'm really proud of that, not because of the fact that I created it, but I'm proud of the fact that I think it really lives up to that idea of simple scratch cooking. I think it makes baking a lot more approachable and less intimidating, because baking does scare people. It is a science that you do need to respect, and it can be humbling when you have a baked recipe fail. And the fact that I could give that to home cooks, and maybe it's the difference between baking a batch of cupcakes for the school bake sale as opposed to buying something, I feel very proud of being able to offer that.
I think what distinguishes this book is you really demystify a lot of the everyday cooking.
Well, you know, the kitchen is supposed to be a fun place. The kitchen is my happy place. It's been my happy place for a very long time. And I want people to see that it can be their happy place as well. It doesn't have to feel like a chore. It doesn't have to be a chore. It can be a place that inspires you. It's a place where you head to when you want to show the people in your life how much you love and care for them.
Well, you know, the part of the thing that amazes me is you've had tragedies, I think, in your life, and you come through so happy and full of love. I see your picture in here, and I really think you're like somebody I would like to know.
Thank you. I appreciate hearing that.
You look comforting and welcoming and organized.
That's what a lot of my friends say. I will say one of my dearest friends who I mentioned in a couple of the headnotes, Erin, she always says when she walks into my house, she feels like she's home. And that's really the environment that I love to create. I love to create a warm and welcoming place, whether it's in my own house, whether I'm on vacation. We have an annual trip that we take to Cape Cod every year. We were doing it from the first year my husband and I met each other 17 summers ago, and he used to always marvel at that within an hour of being pulled into the house at the beach, everything was unpacked, the dish towels were out, the cutting board was there, that I had this ability to walk in someplace and give it that sense of home. And I think, honestly, it's because it's something I was striving for. I had a little bit of turmoil growing up as a kid, so I think I've always been striving for that sense of home, you know, being able to create roots someplace is very important for me.
Tell us about these icons that you used, the icons that you used in the book, like Pantry Basics.
Yeah.
For you. Tell us about those. That also helps guide people to what they're doing.
Well, you know, the icons, I was really motivated for those. I have a lot of people in my life that have food allergies and sensitivities.
We all do.
since Isabella started school, we've encountered so many kids who either have a nut allergy, an egg allergy, a dairy allergy. I have a lot of gluten-free people in my life. I have a lot of people in my life who are vegetarian. So I wanted those icons. I wanted people to be able to flip through that book very quickly and see, oh, wow, this book could be for me. There are a lot of egg-free recipes, or, gee, there's a lot of gluten-free recipes, or this person really understands that it could be challenging if you're dairy-free. I think those icons really do sum up the idea that food is about love. It's about it being approachable and nourishing and welcoming. And to be able to look through that book and see that it's an all-inclusive book was really important for me. And for people who are dealing with food sensitivity, I wanted to demystify it a little bit, because it can be, especially when you're first transitioning to a new lifestyle in terms of your diet. You do have to be so careful of every ingredient in a recipe. And I wanted to try and make it feel like it was a little bit more manageable for people.
Yeah, but you take everything a step further, if you don't mind my saying so, Jen. Cooking from scratch is one thing. You don't buy cake mixes. You don't, you know, do that kind of thing. But how many people make their own nut butters?
Honestly, it's really easy, and that's one of the few recipes in the book that really does require having a piece of equipment, which is the food processor. Most of the techniques in the book, say biscuits, for example, or muffins, you might normally just cut your butter in with a food processor. I purposely wrote those recipes that you use just your fingers, so that people didn't feel like they needed a special tool to go into the kitchen. But in terms of the nut butters, that's really important. If your child has a peanut allergy and you want to start looking into, because I know people who their kids have a peanut allergy, but they can have other nuts. There's a little girl in my daughter's pre-K class. Well, as soon as you start looking for, say, cashew butter, you walk into the health food store, you see how expensive that is. But if you can just pick up cashews and just process them yourself. So, yeah, not everyone is making their own nut butters, but that recipe is in there really to also open up your eyes to see that you can make a lot more than peanut butter at home. And honestly, cashew butter, I love that mixed with jelly on a sandwich better than peanut butter. And I'm a peanut butter and jelly aficionado. I ate that for most of elementary school in my lunch.
Favorite section, actually, is your pizzas, savory tarts, and breads. In fact, I wish you were around just to make me cheese crackers.
Those cheese crackers are very, very yummy. Those are a very popular recipe in the book right now, too. I know that they're being packed in a lot of school lunches.
Is there any particular section that you're particularly proud of? Or you even
have
movie
say,
theater popcorn. I don't know. you have all bases covered.
You know, the movie theater popcorn, it's really because popcorn at home doesn't always live up to the expectation of that salty, buttery popcorn that you get at the movie theater that everybody wants. And a lot of times that salty, buttery popcorn at the movie theater has a lot of chemicals in it from some powder with ingredients we can't pronounce. So that movie theater popcorn, it really hits on those notes of a little bit of butter, a little bit of salt in there. But again, it's made with ingredients that you can understand and you can pronounce. In terms of the sections, I don't know. Picking a section out of a cookbook that's my favorite might be asking me to also choose which one of my daughters
right,
is my
exactly.
favorite. I'd be pretty hard-pressed to say that. But I do think that each chapter really can stand its own ground on itself. I think they all really have something unique and special to offer the home cook.
Yeah, well, I think that this is a wonderful addition to anybody's cookbook library. Again, it's Jennifer Perillo. It's Homemade with Love, and with photographs by Penny de los Santos, the great photographer.
The wonderful photographer.
Oh, she's incredible, of course. I mean, that's part of the reason these cheese crackers look so great. Baked potato
chips. Well, thank you so much for having me on the show today.
And good luck with lots of success with this book. And do you want to give us your blog again?
Yep, my blog is In Jenny's Kitchen, and Jenny is Jenni.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
And you have a good tour. Bye-bye.
And we'll be back with more home cooking right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, welcome back, sweetheart. Who's up next?
We're talking to Suzanne Landry, staying in this amorous zone about home cooking, and she wrote a book called The Passionate Vegetable.
Which is interesting because it's not a vegetarian cookbook. It's a flexitarian cookbook.
Which is the hot thing to be now.
And she has a wonderful philosophy about home cooking, too. So I think you'll enjoy this interview very much. So let's, without further ado, let's go to it.
I've talked to Suzanne Landry for only a few seconds practically, but I already love her. She is totally non-judgmental, even though she's known as being a promoter of a healthy lifestyle and a healthy diet. She's known also as the fresh food chef, and she's produced a book which stands out from a number of other similar books we've been receiving about healthful dining, flexitarian diets, vegetables. It's called The Passionate Vegetable, health-inspired recipes to revitalize your life for vegetarians or meat lovers, all. And if you see her photograph on the back cover of the book, you're going to subscribe to this diet because she looks pretty darn good. Hello, Suzanne. Tell us about how this is a book that has multiple applications. It's not for vegetarians, it's not for one segment of the population, it's for a variety, and for what reasons?
My biggest message is please eat fresh food in high quality as much as you can afford and you can obtain in the area that you live in. It's not about being a vegetarian, vegan, meat eater. It's not about any of that. It's about, in fact, the first 50 pages of the book helps people to decide and give them the compelling reason why they should be more conscious of the quality of food that they're choosing. Another section of the book talks about balancing pH. So when I'm telling people to or recommending to people to have a more balanced diet, it's more about ratio on the plate. There's two major things that when people say, I want to eat healthier, how can I do this? Two simple ways. One is upgrade the quality of food that you're eating. So instead of canned fruit, have some fresh food. Instead of frozen vegetables or canned vegetables, have some fresh vegetables. Those are very simple changes people can make. The second most important is changing the ratio of what the plate looks like. Instead of having a big old hamburger with french fries, now we maybe have a hamburger without the bun, without the french fries, but maybe a salad as well. That's a whole better acid-alkaline ratio. And we're eating a very, very acid diet in America. And the only food category that really helps us to alkalize is vegetables, and we're not getting enough of them. The research shows that less than 10% of adults are getting their five to seven fruits and vegetables a day, and children are getting even less than that. Or actually, it's the other way around. Children are getting 10%. Adults are getting 5% of their 5 to 7. I've heard talk that we're trying to actually expand the recommendation 9 to 11. The only way that I can do a lot of vegetables is I juice in the morning. But getting back to what the best recommendation is, so your dinner plate, instead of it looking, imagine the circle, and I was raised on meat, potatoes, and vegetables. My mom's English, I love her.
My husband's English, I love him too.
I think I could see that, yes. And it was very much, I mean, when I visited England several times, you get a roast, pot roast for lunch. It's very meat-based, but that's much of Europe.
Stayed around longer, you'd find that it's really sweets-based. You'll get more desserts than roast.
This is true. Oh, we couldn't miss our little crumpets and scones and little treats and sweets at tea time, I tell you. That's for sure. Anyway, so that portion, if you look at the plate, 50% of my plate was always animal protein. Growing up during the war, I'm sure that's influenced my mother, that she, when she could afford the red meat, we had plenty of it when we were growing up. We never starved, for sure. And the plate also contained the potatoes, which is usually your ethnic choice, is white rice or potatoes and lots of white bread. I'm sure Wonder Bread was part of our diet. The problem lies not in the fact that I was eating animal protein. The fact is that the vegetables was too small of a portion of my overall meal. It was probably 30%, and unfortunately probably cooked too much, perhaps.
Oh, cooked to death. That's
10 minutes of cooking most vegetables, you will lose 60-80% of the vitamin C. Now, not all vegetables are high in vitamin C. Carrots, for instance, are not known for their high levels of vitamin C, but tomatoes are, peppers are. So certain vegetables you want to cook lightly if possible, or the alternative, certainly half-cooked vegetables. But have some raw vegetables throughout the day in a salad or some kind of, even a coleslaw is high in vitamin C. Cabbage is extremely high in vitamin C. But if you have raw vegetables as well as cooked vegetables and your overall vegetable intake is now 50% of that plate and the meat becomes 30%, then you will stay alkalized, you will maintain good health if you have it, and might even recover some health issues. I'm not going to make claims here, but you may even recover. Yeah.
I recovered mine. I should point out that you're not really just, because it's very popular and it's even trendy now to talk this way. You're not a newbie. You've been teaching this professionally for 30 years. So you're an educator and you know what you're talking about.
No, I have two questions.
Yeah.
And I'm a little confused about both of them. You said that the problem with the diet that many people have now is it's too acidic, but yet, if I understand it correctly, a lot of fruits are quite acidic. Now, what's the difference there?
The sugar content of the fruit will determine how acidic it is. Cantaloupes, for instance, are very alkaline. They do have some sweet in them. Lemons, we think is very acidic, are actually have an alkaline effect on the pH of our body. So it's not so easy to determine that something is acidic or high in sugar may necessarily be acidic in the system. In order to balance the acidity of animal protein, we need to have 75% of our food to be more alkaline, toward more alkalinity. And vegetables, mostly all green vegetables, the greener the vegetable, and these are vegetables, honestly, that are very popular, although they're wildly popular in California right now. I don't know about in the East Coast, but kale is the king. Everybody's loving kale.
Yeah, I saw you had a kale recipe. I didn't discard your book just because of it, but I'm so sick to death of kale. Razor and kale, all of a sudden, this is big, hot, trendy.
Yeah, but we had kale last night, and we have some left for tonight
too.
Or tomorrow night. Now, I had a second question.
According
to the powers that be and the god of all, Clarence Birdseye, who was, of course, as you know, a guy, not a made-up name, when they freeze the vegetables, they freeze them so much more quickly than they can reach a store where you might buy them and they, after they've sat on the shelf for several days. So frozen vegetables are fresher. Now, tell me that's wrong.
No, I'll tell you it's wrong. It's right. Most companies that will grow produce for deliberately right to the frozen market actually have processing plants in their land or very close to where there is. So they are processed the minute they're picked or washed or whatever. Yes, I won't deny that at all, and I will recommend if you're in a colder climate, you're in one of those states that you just can't get very fresh vegetables, or the vegetables are at least a week old by the time they arrive, which is not too uncommon, then some alternatives, frozen might be a good alternative. However, when you freeze something or cook something, you destroy the enzyme. Enzymes are needed for us to digest our food. So if the only vegetable a person was eating was frozen vegetables, that would not be good.
If you have
raw as well as fresh and or frozen, when you can't get fresh, that would probably be a better arrangement.
Well, thank you very much for clarifying that, because it was obviously a little confusing to have you worry about the fact that something's not as fresh. Now, canned is generally not such a good alternative.
No, the vitamins and minerals pretty much leach out into the water, and then you have usually a fair amount of sodium in there to maintain it. So between the two of them, it's not an alternative. But I do have, what do I have in my cabinet? I have canned organic tomatoes, because they're wonderful quick, and honestly, because they are probably picked and canned very quickly after they're picked, they have a delicious sweetness to them and freshness to them, especially the organic ones that I'm enjoying, much better than the ones that I can get in the store this time of the year as well. Even in California, we are growing tomatoes, but they're usually hothouse tomatoes, or we're getting them from Mexico, and they've already, by the time they reach our stores, including our health food stores, they're about a week old. They've traveled 1,500 miles, so they've lost. They don't pick them when they're ripe, so they haven't gotten the sun ripened nutrients and phytochemicals developed. So by the time they get to the store, they're finally pink or almost red, but they don't have the same flavor as a sun. Everybody knows, hopefully everybody has ever experienced a sun-ripened tomato, freshly picked and in season. There's no comparison. And by the way, I need to say this about, people don't know this, or most people don't know this, that tomatoes are fruit, and fruit hates to be refrigerated. I know you guys know. But tomatoes really need to be unrefrigerated if you want to maintain nice and fresh. I can take a sun-ripened tomato I got at Farmer's Market that just picked this morning in the month of July, put it in my refrigerator, and the next day it's going to be mealy and just lose all its sweetness. The sugars start to break down in the refrigerator, and it becomes starchy. So that's true when I buy peaches in season or I buy other fruits. Most of them I do not refrigerate.
Now, this is not exactly about the book itself, but I was just out of curiosity. Where do you come down on this raw food movement?
Well, we're nuts about this in California. And I've been to a raw food restaurant in Santa Monica that I absolutely adore. And I think when I eat there that I could probably eat like that all the time, fully knowing that I really can't. I think raw food, first off, if a food is cooked and or animal protein, let's take a meat-based diet as opposed to a vegetarian diet, and then we'll look at raw as well. A meat-based diet is going to create more body heat. The longer a food has to sit in the stomach and it takes for it to digest, the more energy your body uses to digest it, that energy expends or produces heat as it being spent. So eating a piece of beef stew, even a piece of chicken, is going to produce more body heat than my having a raw salad. So if I have cooked vegetables, also a little bit of heat, but nothing in comparison to animal protein. So now we have raw, hardly any heat at all. And plus, it adds a huge amount of water to us, which is great, but it doesn't produce warmth. I remember years and years ago when I lived back east, Ann Wigmore's Hippocrates Institute moved from Massachusetts, I believe that's where they originally were, down to Florida because eating all the raw food, they just couldn't maintain. I met someone, they said they would be heating things in their gloves because they couldn't stay warm.
Really?
So depending on the climate you live in, like if I lived in the southern hemisphere in a really, really hot tropical island, my diet would lean toward more raw simply because that's probably what's freshest and I could get it and it wouldn't require a lot of digestion on my part and would stay, keep me cool. This is why spices, although this has nothing to do with raw and cooked, spices produce an immediate sweat, really, really hot spices. Not everybody, but those who have had jalapeno and Dutch bonnets can attend to how you just break out in a sweat almost immediately.
Wrong country.
But the sweating, what it's doing, the body is trying to get rid of the heat, and it opens up the pores. Excess fluid or excess, basically perspiration comes out, but the end result of that sweat is a cooling temperature of the body in response to that heat. So that's why you have hot climates in India and you have Latin American countries. They have far more spice in their diet. And me, went from the East Coast, I was not used to spices, especially from my mom. Her spice cabinet was salt, pepper, and butter. That was it.
Right.
So I wasn't used to that at all. I came out here, and I'm getting used to it now with all the Mexican food out here in California. So the raw food, I think it's good for some people. I just caution people not to jump into the latest and greatest diet trend, including gluten-free, by the way, which are really...
Oh, please, I'm so fed up with...
So am I. I'm right there with you.
I just got three new varieties of gluten-free salad dressing.
For heaven's sakes, yeah.
What is it that has gluten in your oil and vinaigrette?
Well, some of them may use a little bit of gluten to thicken the salad dressing, and maybe that's, but they're addressing the celiacs. The people have celiac disease. I have a girlfriend who has celiac, and she has two toasters in her kitchen. And if you're over there and you eat wheat toast, and she has it for you,
you have got to use that toaster.
Yeah. Yeah, if she has one crumb of wheat in her toaster, she could be in a lot of pain.
Oh, yeah, but it's gotten way beyond that.
It has totally gotten way beyond.
Well, you know what? We're getting a little away from something that I just wanted to mention here before we wrap this, Suzanne, is that Got Recipes is the cookbook, okay? And we haven't talked at all about the recipes.
Oh.
There's one I picked out that looked wonderful to me called Roasted Fresh Fig with Goat Cheese. Tell us about that.
Well, we get several varieties of figs here in California. We have actually fig trees in some of our parks, so it's very easy to get here. You've got to use fresh figs. This is not for any dehydrated or dried figs. Cadota is the one I use because it's got a nice flat bottom, and it's very bulbous on the bottom, and it's easy for stuffing. Some of the other ones don't stand up. Some of the other ones are not big enough to stuff. And I just mix goat cheese with a little bit of chopped rosemary, and I have a little cookie press, a little a pastry type of thing, and I just shoot it in the center, what you do is a cross cut on top of the fig, and you put in probably no more than a half a teaspoon to a teaspoon of this wonderful goat cheese inside the fig. Take prosciutto, and you want to wrap it around the outside of the fig and put a toothpick in it to hold it together. You want to roast it about 400 degrees for about 12 minutes, and you want the prosciutto to begin to sweat and begin to cook a little bit. And it'll start cooking the fig, but you don't want to overdo it because then you'll have this big, very soft, mushy, tasty but mushy mess. You just want to get it so the prosciutto caramelizes a little bit.
Well, it looks delicious. Your photographs are wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
And I want to mention that you have, for those who really want more imaginative dishes, you have whole sections on whole grains and also on bean cuisine, which is something I love.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you get the best out of all the ingredients you're dealing with.
Thank you. Thank you. That's what I was attempting. I wanted to have a book that a vegan could pick up and say, wait a minute, there's tons of choices in here for me. I don't eat myself. I don't eat dairy food, and I don't eat wheat. I'm not gluten intolerant, but I don't eat wheat. So my recipes are pretty much created with not having those in there. I have maybe one or two dishes that give you an alternative for a cheese topping. There's lots of alternative cheeses out there, but it is not a lot of vegetarian cookbooks out there. My God, if you take cheese out of the recipe, there's hardly anything left. And that's why I didn't want people to have to depend on dairy food to get their protein. And I remember one of our first books that was out popular, oh my gosh, back in the 80s, Frances LePay's book, Diet for a Small Planet.
Oh, sure.
She had cheese and bloody everything.
That was
right?
Our Bible.
But she came back years later on and went, you know what? I'm kind of coming back from that. I realized that we don't need to be putting dairy in everything. She was just concerned there wouldn't be enough protein in, so she threw that in there. But she's since rescinded and redone her book, I believe.
Or her daughter has.
Oh, is it her daughter? Oh, okay.
Anyhow, well, this is a very interesting book. Again, it's called The Passionate Vegetable. And Suzanne Landry knows what she's talking about, so I pick up this book, The Fresh Food Chef Will Not Steer You Wrong. And thank you again for talking to us, Suzanne.
You're very welcome.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. If this what's for dinner is a familiar question on a daily basis for you, you'll probably welcome this next book. Of course, the author, Deborah Pondek, has an advantage since she's a professionally trained and acclaimed chef. But she sets out to give us all the tools and ammunition we need for the dinner time survival. Deborah Pondek is one busy woman, busy mother of three. Hello, and they're at that age, which is not easy when they probably all have different activities, don't they, Deborah?
Absolutely. Well, they're young teens and teenagers, so they are definitely going in different directions,
right.
But it makes it fun.
Now, you actually are a chef, and you were the first female chef to get 3 New York Times stars when you were at Montrachet. That's quite an accomplishment.
Yes, those were the good old days.
The
that was a fun time. I really enjoyed it.
And so you've written other cookbooks as well. I counted, including the current one we're going to be talking about, which is the Dinner Time Survival Cookbook. There are, what, 4 others?
Yeah, there's 3 others, and this is the 4th.
Right. You have a busy business as well. You work the business with your husband, and it's gourmet stores. Is this what kind of things you handle in these stores?
Yeah, we started doing, our primary thing is doing takeout food for dinner. And then we sort of expanded into doing things for breakfast. We make our own croissant. We make our own danishes, things like that. We have omelets. And then we offer great salad choices for lunch and homemade soups. Everything is made from scratch. Sandwiches, things like that. And then for dinner, we run the whole affair from whether it's roasted salmon or filet mignon or chicken tenders for your kids. Hopefully we cover whether it's the working mom, the family, the bachelor. We're hopefully sort of soup to nuts, we have everything that you could need to bring home for your healthy meals.
Now, aren't you worried that this book will cut into business?
You know what? So far it hasn't. I've given away every trade secret I can. I think it's important to share your knowledge and applaud people who are still cooking and still... I would say cook what you love to cook. We'll supply the rest. Sometimes it comes around holiday or things like that, and you don't want to think about making the whole meal. So I always say make what you love to make and come to Odalise and get the rest of it. So it's worked out well so far.
Now, you have three children.
I do.
And it seems that somewhere between one and three children, it gets to be more difficult to get everybody organized to eat dinner together all at the same time and have it be a real meal. Do you do that?
I actually do. It's one of my goals is that we probably sit down as a family at least five nights out of the seven.
Amazing.
Only because my daughter has a later dance that she does. But every other night we sit down, my husband is home from work, and we have dinner together. It was kind of one of my sticking points that this was going to happen. And we all have generally breakfast together as well. So, I know it's hard with everybody's schedule, but we also try not to schedule too many things that run late or just the luck of our schedules that they don't happen too much exactly during the dinner hour, because I know people that are on the run and having meals in their cars and things like that, and it gets crazy.
But don't you think your book is a contribution to people who want that to happen but are failing because the recipes are so good? People will want to have dinner at home because the food's better.
Well, I hope so. They're pretty simple, and as I always said, I think people get into making, myself included, if I could ask all my friends, what do you make during the week? And people spout off the same five or seven things. It's kind of what you know, I know the recipe, I know what I have to shop for, I know the family likes it, so those recipes just go in rotation. So my thought was that if I could get some of these, the recipes in the Dinner Time Survival Cookbook into that rotation, and if they become just sort of a reference thing of remembering, maybe you don't even go back and open the book, and you kind of remember that the barbecued salmon tacos were simply barbecued salmon and some avocado and some tomato, and you can kind of replicate it and add some things in to sort of shake things up for your family, and hopefully, that will make dinner time a little bit more enjoyable.
Now, you have a number of tips. You make it so easy. Reading this book, it seems brilliantly easy. But one of the most difficult things, I think, is it's absolutely essential, but you push organization. And that's probably the thing that most people lack.
I really do. I'm that one who's like, I set my breakfast table the night before. My coffee's set up the night before. If I'm making pancakes, all the dry stuff is done, because I'm pretty bleary-eyed first thing in the morning. But if I'm ready to go, it just makes it... I can't stress that to people enough. I know sometimes the thought of chop the vegetables in the morning while you're kind of doing breakfast like seems like, oh, just no way. But I can't tell you, once you've done it and the ease of marinating that steak before you run off to work, when you come home, you've got a beautifully marinated piece of chicken or fish or meat or whatever. It's just, you're just going to love it. So I think you have to get people sort of to break the mold of doing everything at 5 o'clock when they rush through the door.
Yes. Somebody we were talking to recently, I can't remember who it was. She was a restaurant chef, but the book was clearly oriented towards the home cook. And she said that. And she said that there really is a problem. There's a transition that people have to make from cooking as a chef in a restaurant, which you did in a very fine restaurant.
Right.
Where you had help surrounding you in every direction. You were mostly supervising and tasting a little bit, but not really doing all the cooking, because you had a brigade that did that. And she said the awkward transition is when great chefs produce cookbooks containing all their great restaurant recipes, but they don't change them so that they're feasible to do at home. Then what's happening is, in a sense, the book's being sold by false pretenses, because you're not going to be able to cook like Daniel Hume in his 11 Madison Park cookbook, because it needs a brigade to do that. You can't transfer that at home, and it seems to me you must have done that. Now, what were some of the things you had to learn in order to successfully make that transition?
Well, I actually started doing that on my first book, and the first thing I did is everybody would say, oh, why don't you just test the recipes at work? You have so much more room. Use the ovens. Use the pans. And I said,
right.
No. I want to know whether on my counter space, do I have 50 things, or can I feasibly do this in a very average kitchen? How does it work with my oven? On the stove space, am I trying to juggle too many things, or is it really realistic? And that, I think just doing it myself and doing it at home did make it easier to really even just physically see whether the recipes made sense and what I was doing, and the pots and pans that I had, the utensils and things like that. Was I calling for things that were kind of crazy? So I think scaling it down, doing it on a real level basis, because you're right, some of the the things, like, they, we're lucky, as you go through recipes, you realize that not everybody has veal stock. They don't have veal stock at home or creme fraiche. So you learn to, and you have to really adapt some of these recipes. You're right. In a restaurant, we have every stock imaginable, you know, quail stock, pheasant stock. At home, you don't. So you end up really with a chicken or vegetable or maybe something simple that you can recreate. But it really has to be something that you can make, not go out to, and not everybody, we have a, maybe a New York audience and an LA audience. But if you're in the middle of the country, you might not have a gourmet food store that sells creme fraiche or sells like a fish fumet or something. So you really have to make the books, I think, universal for everybody, whatever part of the country they're cooking in.
I'll just steal a quote from Bobby Flay, his testimonial, and he says, I love when talented chefs show us a little behind-the-scenes glimpse of their family meals. Deborah Ponczak is the perfect to guide you through the rough-and-tumble chore of feeding your household. No one will want to leave the table. And I think that this is actually what elevates this book. You have the basic talent and ability behind it. You're not a TV star who's on for the 20... No, I was about to quote a title of a book, which I won't do, which was Cheap and Quick Meals. So you know what you're talking about, and I think, and your creativity comes through. So I think that really elevates these recipes. There's not a boring one in the whole lot.
Oh, you're so sweet to say so. Well, I think that's part of my culinary school background, is that I am kind of a classic chef. I believe in technique, and that's why we sort of say in the book, it is still cooking, because while I believe in, I'm the same person who walks in the door at 5 or 5:30, and I still have to get dinner on the table. Like, so I get that, but I also realize that there's basic techniques that people, to really be successful, you want them to be successful and not say, oh, I tried this recipe, I just didn't get it. And there are, you do need to explain it in recipes and tell people how to do things or give them insight or give them new ways to do things so that they're successful and not frustrated. But it does take kind of a, I'd say, like a classic technique background.
Yeah, well, I think it comes through in every recipe here. And I want to point out that these recipes, although they're for the home cook, they're not boring at all. They're everyday recipes. Here's one for sweet potato salad with mango. Now, that's rather extraordinary.
That
oh, yeah, and of course, I love your husband's favorite recipe. Is it Moroccan?
You know, Moroccan lamb stew.
Lamb stew.
Oh, I know. It's so funny.
That's
he loves that recipe. And I made it, obviously, a few times to test the book and stuff. And he wasn't even a huge lamb stew fan, but he's like, I love this lamb stew. So to turn people around, maybe, as to what they... And that's why I wanted to organize the book by food chapters, so that often, I don't know, maybe I'm the only one, but I can wake up at 7 in the morning, and I'm always saying, I'm putting it out there, what do you guys want for dinner? And they're like, Mom, we're still on this. We're on the breakfast still. And I'm like, I know, but I have to think, do I have to shop? Do I have to pull something from the freezer? What's it? Am I pulling some from the pantry? So I kind of have to have an idea. So usually it's a general, well, let's have pasta tonight. Well, let's do burgers. So this way the book is set up in those sort of subject chapters so that hopefully if, you know, they can throw out an idea or two, you have a chapter to go right to.
Yeah, I like the groupings of these recipes too.
Well, like Sarah Moulton, you have a chapter on breakfast for dinner.
Yeah, right.
It's one of my favorite. When we were young, we thought, you know, we didn't realize we were just eating all carbs for breakfast. We thought that was, like, the greatest thing. And so it still works once in a while. Because every once in a while, no matter what, you can have at your fingertips or you can be shopping at the best place. Just sometimes you're just not in the mood for the steak or the pork or the chicken. Just nothing really appeals to you. And somehow on those, like, once in a while nights, I feel like the omelet or a strata or something like that just is, it will sort of do the trick.
If you cook this well every night, Deborah, what do you pull out for the big event?
You know what? Surprisingly, that's a very funny you said that, because a friend of mine who has the book said, oh, I feel like we've had a lot of these recipes over, you know, they come over our house when we entertain, a lot of these recipes over the year when you're cooking. And I said, it's true, because really, sometimes a lot of it's just in the presentation. The short ribs, for example, in this book are ones that I do at home for a very fancy party. And sometimes it's just in the plating of things and all that. I actually don't tend to stray too far from, I think when I was younger, maybe not that I don't try to cook to impress, because I do want my guests to have a fantastic meal, but I realize that...
As a chef, you've got to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. But buying great product and, you know, doing things that are simple, because people still want recognizable food. They don't want to, I can serve something, somebody so wacky and crazy, but they're sort of like, they're not sure how to eat it or they're not sure what it is. It doesn't really make it to make my ego bigger. I'd rather serve like a great rack of lamb or roasted chicken or something with maybe an unusual side dish, other than making the whole thing too complicated or too fussy.
Well, I think you succeeded here, and I might point out to people who are familiar with cookbooks and food writing,
writing that you worked with Mary Goodbody, who's like the best of the best as a food writer
on
this
book.
And yeah, so, and the result is, I think it'll really give people who are in this situation, having to cook and learn as I did it long enough, it gives you a boost and makes it within your reach to actually pull off something that's interesting for you as well as the people you're feeding. I wish you a lot of luck with this, Deborah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Again, it's the Dinner Time Survival Cook.
And we can survive dinner time as a result. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. I hope so. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And don't go away, because right after the break, you're going to find out not only how to survive dinner time from a cooking perspective, but also from a financial perspective. So we'll be back with that right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, sweetheart, what's up next?
The $20 20-minute meal, and if it sounds too good to be true, just listen up to Caroline Wright.
Well, what is it? You spend less of what you'd like to spend less of, and you get more time which you'd like to have. How about that?
Right. Caroline Wright is attacking our current situation right on with a book called $20 20-minute meals. Welcome to On the Menu, Caroline.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And you hit right on the head of what's going on now. Even though we're in supposedly an economic recovery, we still don't have enough money. We still never have enough time. So are these your motivations for writing this book?
Absolutely. I feel like regardless of how much time or money you have in your back pocket, it's still always an excuse to get a delicious meal to the table. So that's just the goal for everybody, regardless of age or your budget, either time or money.
Well, you are a very busy and prestigious professional, trained at the École de Cuisine La Varenne. You're a food editor, recipe developer, TV producer, stylist, which takes a lot of patience, teacher, more patience still. And your writings have appeared in what everybody's reading this day, Real Simple, Martha Stewart, Cooking Light, Every Day with Rachel Ray. So yeah, I don't know when you find time.
Well, as you've hit the nail on the head,
exactly.
I too am obviously, I'm busy, so I like to cook when I come home from my day job too, which just happens to be in the kitchen. So these are the sort of recipes that I like to cook when I come home.
Now, you have a different format. Don't have like the little list of what the ingredients are and what the step-by-step instructions are. You have things highlighted in yellow. Can you explain that?
Yeah, exactly. I also personally feel I love the traditional recipe format, my bread and butter, like I say, but doing it this way in this sort of conversational style, I just wanted to focus on something, the way of telling the story of these recipes in a way that's the most approachable way as possible, as though I'm in the kitchen with you. You're taking this book to the grocery store, it's on a small scale format so that that's easy enough to do. Having the ingredients highlighted in that sort of way is easy enough to make an ingredient list or grocery shopping list from that, and just showing that the ingredients are easy enough to add in this sort of conversational way. And also I feel like a step-by-step ingredient method sometimes makes the recipes appear longer than they actually are, or more complicated than they actually are. Yeah.
On the page, they take up more space.
Yeah, exactly. So I feel like this is a way just show that this recipe is not only short, but it's very easy to do, and this is how you do it.
Well, Dory Greenspan put it exactly what I was thinking about, and she says that you have a great feel for the way we want to cook and eat these days. And of course, Dory should know. She's fabulous, isn't she?
She is fabulous.
Tell us what, because we're getting a lot of these books across our desk right now, lots of busy family cookbooks and that sort of thing. I guess everybody's in the same fix, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Aside from the format of highlighting it with yellow highlighter, what are some of the other things that distinguish this book from all the others in that market?
Well, sure. I sort of feel like the recipe, you'll notice on the cover it says that these recipes are for four people. Well, originally, the group of people that I was cooking these recipes for were not only just friends with kids and young families, but also just the 20-somethings overworked and underpaid 20-somethings that I knew. So my group group of four people at a table, what weren't necessarily the mom, dad, and two kids that you know. So I encourage people of all different all tables of shapes and sizes to bring different foods and interesting things to the table. And that's one of the focuses, that it's not just imagining, like, necessarily a five-year-old child at the table, even though certainly encouraging anyone to eat new food is it's a great thing. Another thing that it's very seasonally focused, so it's focusing on trying to get new and interesting, different things to the table, things that you might not have heard of, so it encourages the sort of everyday cook to expand their palate a little bit through, for example, Szechuan peppercorns in the recipe, some of the recipes, different produce, for example, ramps, another thing that everyone around the country might not have gotten their hands on before, things like that, just because I feel like bringing different things to the table is how people learn how to cook and find new favorite ingredients and things to cook. And I suppose lastly, the difference is that I encourage people to look at dinner entirely differently. I choose to say that dinner is sometimes going to be a bowl of soup and a piece of bread if you're running out to a movie or something like that. It's not always going to be steak and potatoes. But because you aren't cooking steak and potatoes, I don't believe that you have to eat cereal either. So going down the middle, I believe that this is sort of a secret third option of different types of meals that are available to you.
Now, you said that the recipes in the book were aimed at a group of four people who were probably mostly adults. We were interviewing somebody recently. I think it's Dining Survival or something like that was the name of the book.
Dinner Time.
We asked the author, we said, do you sit down for dinner every night with your family? And she said, yes, we make a rule that we're going to do that 5 days a week. Now, are you doing the same thing?
Every night that I can, for sure. And I actually happen to have a family now. I have a
right, yeah, I read that.
Which is exciting. He's certainly not eating ramps yet.
And then go on to eating only white food, and then he'll like Thai food, and then it changes every week.
Well, I know. It's so funny. Yeah, Melissa Clark's white food article was great.
Forgot about that. She's funny. Well, Ruth Reichel's kid only ate white food till he was like a preteen or something.
That's amazing. It's true. It's an affliction that all food writers seem to have. It's just the plight of the picky eater. But I haven't reached that sort of arena yet. No, to answer your question, yes. Every weekend, I would have a group of upwards of 10, 15 friends over, and then we would cook together sometimes. But every time, we would have a lot of recipes that were very similar to this, different types of pasta, eggs. Obviously, to have to think about things that were quick and serviceable and easy for a large group of people to eat, mostly off of paper plates, but usually all too fabulous food to be eating as sort of quotidian way that we were eating it. But it was great. It's absolutely my life.
Of course, you're living in the center of temptation and also readily available pre-cooked food. You're in Brooklyn.
What's so funny, I actually just happened to move away from Brooklyn temporarily right before this book came out. So my son, my husband, and I are living in Dallas just for the moment, but we are on our way back to Brooklyn in the next couple of months, which is great. But yes, normally, yes, I am in Brooklyn with my friend, cooking every weekend and eating these big meals. And it's true, I am inspired by the sort of center of food world at the moment, being in the different boroughs and getting all sorts of different food at your table, which is great.
Now, give us an idea of some of some of the favorite recipes that you have that are here in this book.
So funny. I love that question because it's obviously completely natural. But it's so hard to choose because all of them I love for different reasons.
Well, here's one I grew up on was the asparagus omelet. And the thing is that people tend to eat that for, like, breakfast or brunch. But it used to be a dinner staple in my house growing up.
Oh, actually, it's true. Mine, too. Omelets were a favorite in my house. I guess to answer your question, so funny, and I kind of talk about this in the intro, I prefer seasonal foods, obviously, so that also means, like, what the temperature is outside, and I happen to be calling you from Florida at the moment, so I would never answer mac and cheese in this 90-degree weather. It's terrible. So, I mean, at the moment, my favorite types of food that I really would want are booked. There's a spring green salad with poached chicken and buttermilk dressing. That sounds fabulous and exactly what I want to be eating right now.
Here's one that would go over well in England, radish, watercress, and butter sandwiches.
Oh, yes. Yes, delicious. Actually, my husband and I used to, when we were in Paris, I met him in college, used to pack up sandwiches like that with camembert and butter and just take them to whatever park was nearest and just sit there after school. So that's actually where that came from, was just the sort of things that I like to bring on a picnic.
And another thing that I think is a nice change-up is that sometimes when you have related recipes, like I'm looking at mussels right now, you don't do a whole page. You do each individual recipe, and the photograph is just a little tiny thing. It's like notes. It's like a reference guide.
Yeah, I think it's part of inspiring sort of either the new cook or the seasoned cook with different flavors, is this idea that you can have a sort of template recipe, a sort of master recipe that you can go on to switch up different things and get completely different dishes. And that's a great example of grilled cheese, whether it's just different flavor pairings, like also included in the book, or different soups. It's the same method, but just with different elements thrown in to make completely new flavors.
And you also have very useful little tips, like at the bottom of the recipes, also try, say, a different...
Absolutely. And the reason for that is, just in case you do crave something where the method may work out of season for something that's very similar, I tried to include things so that people could go to the store and still get something that's fresh and delicious and in season. Or sometimes if the ingredient was esoteric, so that people could approximate a flavor or get something interesting to the table without worrying too much.
Now, I have a problem with one of your recipes. I don't know why. Yeah, why would you make pizza with mussels and put the shells in? It'd be a disaster at the table.
Well, it's so funny. And I actually ate something very similar in Italy once, and I just fell completely in love with it because the mussels, when they open, they release the juice on the pizza. It's so delicious. And also, I like eating with my hands, and all my friends, like I said, eating on paper plates. I hardly always think that eating in a sort of creative way is part of the fun. And eating on your pizza, pulling the mussels from their shells and eating them that way. I thought it was fun and interesting, and my friends loved it, so I have no reason to complain.
Yeah, my mother-in-law would not even look at something like that.
Did she like pizza?
She eats it with a knife and fork.
Well, yeah, I guess she does. I don't think she eats it. I don't think she eats it very much at all.
No, that's true too. Well, I think that you break out of the mold of what most people expect one of these fast and easy and inexpensive cookbooks to include. When you start getting into things like Asian ingredients, like simple miso soup with asparagus, edamame, and pan-fried tofu, so you enlarge people's scope with that kind of thing.
Well, yes, it's a great way to think that if you bring different types of cuisines and different types of dishes to the table, if it's takeout or something like that, great, you can cook it well enough at home, and bringing different flavors is a great way to do that.
I have to mention one more, though. Your Greek, these ingredients, never would I ever have put them in one dish. I know it sounds wonderful. I feel like rushing out and getting it. Greek lemon and egg soup, which I love, with dandelion greens, which I also love, but never would I put them together. And that's exciting.
Yeah, what's great about that recipe is the dandelion greens, which, depending on when you get them in the season, can be, tough isn't the right word, but they can be a little bit toothsome. So actually, that's a slightly marinated salad. So it's meant to show people that you marinate it, and you keep the dressing on for a little bit longer, and you put it on top of the soup. It's a really nice mix of flavors, and you're not just eating basically a humble bowl of rice cooked in broth. It's a big, lots of flavors and interesting things going on there.
Well, you're talking to somebody who actually has planted dandelions.
Yes, I love it. I should be going to your house for dinner.
Anyhow, I mean, if you get somebody to help with the landscaping, you know, or garden, they always pull out the dandelions, so you have to occasionally go out and buy the seeds and plant it.
Yeah, if you can't slap their hands, take it away from the table, it's true.
Well, Caroline, I think you've done a great job with this, and I wish you all the luck in the world with it. And
thank you so much.
And you're moving back from, did you say you're in Dallas?
I'm in Dallas temporarily. Yeah, I know. It's very funny.
I don't wish that on anybody. I'm sure to get hate mail over that one.
Oh, it's not so bad. They make them big and nice over here, so that's great.
Well, have fun. Have fun in Florida if you're there.
Yes, I am here.
And enjoy yourself while you're on away from the big city, and then you'll never recognize Brooklyn. If you've been that back, been away for more than 2 weeks, you won't know how good it's gotten by the time you get back.
I know. It's totally true. I'll have all sorts of new favorite spots to try by the time I get back.
Right. Well, thanks again, Caroline.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on.
Uh-huh. It's fun. Bye.
Bye.
So now you're equipped with knowledge. You're equipped with information, you're equipped with passion, you're equipped with how to do it all in less time for less money. And we'll be back same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.